within about 6 months, I knew everyone in the tech space here, and I was going to events and I'd walk in the door and I'd know the people. And that's a really good path to starting to sell in a country.
Everybody, welcome back to the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, Gary Fox. This week, we're chatting to Dee Coakley, the co-founder of Boundless. This could not be a better company to be speaking to right now. Boundless handles all your employment needs when you're hiring people all across the world. It is a hugely complex area, which I really had no understanding about until today. In today's episode, you're going to learn three key things. You're going to learn the key criteria Dee used to identify when starting a business. She was very methodical as to the business must fit this criteria, why you should only sell painkillers and not vitamins, and how you should always give and take advice. Here's my episode with Dee Coakley, the co-founder of Boundless. First, quick thank you to our partners. Thanks to my partner, Square. Everything your business needs, like payments, point of sale, e-commerce, inventory management, chatting endlessly about the weather? Well, you're on your own there. Square. Everything your business needs. Almost. Visit square.com. Dee, welcome to the pod.
Thanks for having me here.
I've been chasing you for a while.
You have. And we just didn't manage to join up those calendars. So yeah, I'm really, really happy to be here. I've been meaning to, well, hoping to come on the pod for quite a long time as well.
Look, it's a milestone for any founder, right?
Absolutely.
You're the kind of founder I want, though, because you're hard to get. And if you're hard to get, my barometer
well,
is like...
Well, maybe it just says something about my organization.
She must be pretty busy. She must be doing some good things. So let's get her on. So I'm delighted you're here. Welcome. First of all, it's cool to chat to you. We've kind of chatted socially and casually. Boundless. Mm-hmm. Talk to me. What does it do?
So Boundless is an international employment platform. So anyone that has ever been involved in hiring people in other countries or trying to convince maybe senior leadership that someone you've got a CV for in another country should be brought on board, or anyone who's tried to move country and convince their employer that they should be able to do it from another country, will have some insights into how tricky and challenging all of that is. And we can talk a bit more about what that entails, but we handle all of the HR compliance, payroll, benefits, so all of the really gruesome, heavy lifting, the stuff that most people would consider extremely mundane. For us, we're very happy that all of that exists because it means we have a great business.
Anywhere there's pain, there's profit, right?
Absolutely.
Anywhere where you're like, I would do anything today apart from this.
Yeah, and we talk to people all the time who have, like me, I spent time trying to solve this problem before founding the business. We talk to people who've tried solving it themselves, and so often on a call, they'll say, this is really good value. You know, there is,
I would pay any money.
It is not a low cost product, but people who've felt the pain are very prepared to pay to have someone else solve these problems for them.
Anyone who knows what their time is worth, I think they're the key people to talk to, because sometimes you're doing something and you're like, I hate doing this, but I have to do it.
Yeah, this is one of those ones that people definitely want to hand it all away.
You are a chameleon in the fact that you've switched from C-level to founder. Why?
It took me a long time to make the decision, to make that transition. So I entered the tech world about 15 years ago. I'd spent quite a few years working in the music industry. Reached a point where I was like, right, it's, you know, I need a grown-up job now. That was a lot of fun, but I want to really build a career, develop that over time. I was playing a long game and wanted to move into tech. So I found myself being a COO for a brilliant business called Masabi, and then went on and was COO at a couple of other businesses, an Irish company called Bazimply and another Irish company called Axonista.
What does a COO do?
So in my case, it's interesting. When I was a COO, you get asked that question a lot. And I often, you know, it's not that long since I was a COO. I was a COO 5 years ago. So I do often end up, people connect me to people who are considering hiring a COO, and they say, my VCs say I need a COO. What does one even do?
What does one look like?
I always used to describe myself as a classic COO, but then COOs come in all kinds of different permutations and combinations. I was always responsible for finance, legal, HR, fundraising. They were my areas. So running and operating the business, the kind of very internal stuff, making sure that everyone was clear on vision and goals and aligned to those goals and that the business was operating the way it should. That's what I did. But, you know, you will come across COOs that might be involved in, sometimes they're involved in DevOps in a product and engineering type environment in a tech company, or they might be involved in sales ops. I spoke to someone recently who was saying that the COO where they are has a real revenue focus and is very, very focused on running the sales team, running sales ops.
So it depends on the company, I guess, what you're working on, what industry you're in.
Well, people will often say the COO should be whatever the CEO is not. I often think I don't have a COO.
Good yet. Advice.
I often think I need one. Yeah, I mean, I think that is how a COO role should be designed. It should be about filling the gaps for the CEO, and the two should really work hand in hand.
So how did you make that leap? Was it like, I just really want to work for myself, or I fancy a crack at the top job, or what was it?
So very early on, when I would have been, I do remember Ben, who was the CEO at Mesabi at the time, saying to me, he was, you know, he it's a, quite a long time now since he was CEO of that business. He moved into a more innovation and product focused role. But I remember early on him saying to me, you know, maybe you can become the CEO. And I remember thinking, oh my God, I don't want to be a CEO. Are you kidding me? So for many years, I loved being a COO. I was very suited to it. It was like I found my calling. It was the right fit for me, for my skill set, my personality type. I was very happy. But like a lot of things, these things run their course. Right. And I reached a point where I was bored. It was more, I was moving to different organizations, but it was more of the same. It was the same role in each of those organizations. And I reached a point where I wanted a big challenge, and I needed a big seismic change. Now, for a few years before that, quite a lot of people that I have always had a big network in the tech space, and a lot of people I knew had said to me many times, "Oh, I assume you're going to start your own thing soon." And I particularly felt, you know, every founder assumes everybody else wants to be a founder.
Yeah, we all assume everyone's just like
yeah,
us.
Yeah.
My wife says that to me all the time. She goes, "Yeah, you know, everyone doesn't think just like you do. That's your big blind spot." Yeah. And it is.
Not everyone wants to start a business.
Yeah.
But a lot of people used to say to me, "Oh, I assume you're working on a few of your own ideas."
It's a compliment in a way, though. It's a big compliment,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, and I remember speaking to someone one day when I was moving on from a role. He said, "Oh, obviously I assume you're looking for a CEO role now." And I remember going, "Oh, me? I couldn't be a CEO."
Yeah, the Irish modesty as well keeps you in your place, doesn't it?
But also being a woman. You know, I had never worked for a woman CEO. And then I did go to an organization and I worked for a woman CEO, Claire McHugh at Accionista. And
Claire, she's
amazing.
Been on the pod. She's great.
Yeah. She is an amazing person, and she has plenty of skills that, you know, I don't have and will never have. But I worked very closely with her, and seeing her in that role definitely caused a shift in my mindset. They always say you can't be what you don't see. And
I said that about an hour and a half ago. Yeah. And I'm a huge believer in that. And that's a big reason for doing the pod, is that I think the Irish tech space, especially, and the Irish entrepreneur space, is very young. As in,
yes,
like, we don't have, sounds weird to say, but role models to point at and go, "Oh, there's D. I'm just like D. Maybe I could be an entrepreneur."
Yeah.
And I think that's why I like profiling everybody and kind of going, "Well, look, you're just like that person, or you're just from there," because you have to see it.
Yeah.
You have to see it, because I can't relate to someone in Silicon Valley. I can't relate to someone in New York. I think you really have to bring it close to home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. You need people that you can actually meet in the flesh and spend time with.
We put people on pedestals, I think, especially here in Ireland. I think we look abroad
and
go, "Oh my God, that person is superhuman." And I definitely do this as well, in terms of, you just assume they have something that you don't.
Yeah, all these personalities on Twitter and perhaps there's not so, you know, they might be great at tweeting.
Maybe they're just a bad person, you know?
Maybe there's not so much behind that. But yeah, it's easy to conjure up in your mind that this person has these superpowers that maybe you don't have. But yeah, it was the perfect storm for me. I'd been a COO for 10 years at that stage. I mean, I overdid it. I should have started my own business years earlier.
You don't know what you don't know, though.
Absolutely. And evidently I wasn't ready, or I would have done it. And it was, I do think it was emotional or kind of self, it was a self-doubt thing. That combined with the fact that I knew a lot of startup founders and I was under no illusions. You know, I knew some startup founders who were successful, but who, you know, over time had confided in me that they were extremely unhappy and they didn't enjoy it. Yeah. And it is an extremely tough slog. It is an extremely tough way to live your life. And as I say, I was under no illusions. So that also put me off. I had this real fear that I'd start something. My biggest fear was that I'd suck, that I'd be rubbish at it, and it would be really embarrassing and I'd fail miserably. And because I had had these 10 years in C-level roles, that people might have expectations that I shouldn't at least know how to run a business. So that the biggest fear was failure, that I suck and it would be awful. And then my other, and I had a really deep-seated fear that I'd start and then I'd go, oh God, what have I got myself into? And you see, there's no easy way out. You can't just hand your notice in.
Yeah, I'm going to give you my 30 days, Gary, okay?
What? You know, it doesn't really work that way. You have to see this journey through, whatever seeing it through means.
Exactly. And who knows what that looks like?
Yeah, you have no idea. But I did know enough. I wasn't green going into it. You know, I wasn't new to the tech world or new to the startup world. I had been to all the conferences. I'd listened to the podcasts. I'd read the books. I'd hung out with a lot of founders. I'd seen, you know, I'd coached so many founders through terrible times. I'd seen people's businesses fail. I'd seen people reach financial ruin and very commonly emotional ruin. And I thought, God, what if I get into it? And it just turns out that I'm waking up in the morning and I'm going, I can't believe I have to do this. I'm really happy to say that absolutely has not happened. And actually, to an extent where I've never been in a job this long, and I realize now, I was probably always meant to be an entrepreneur. I was probably always meant to be a startup founder. And as a result, I had this dissatisfaction in the roles I was in. There was always something eating away at me. And I used to have that feeling of, well, how long am I going to be here? And I always felt kind of trapped. And I had that fear I had a fear that maybe that was just me, that I would feel trapped whatever I was doing. And now I've done this and I never feel that way. I have times when it's really, really hard. There are times where you question your sanity and go, why have I chosen to live my life this way? But I always know that I'm in the right place for me. And I have mornings where I wake up and I go, I'd like to have a lie in today. It's raining outside. And, you know, maybe today I don't feel like doing so much work. That happens. But I never, ever wake up in the morning and think, how do I get out of this? Or I don't want to do Boundless. Or I never question if this is the right thing for me to do or if this was the right business.
That's magic to be able to say that, though, isn't it?
Happy to be able to say that, yeah.
That is absolutely magic. That's one of the rarest gifts you can give yourself, that satisfaction, that happiness. And I think you had done it the right way because, like you said, you're probably always destined to do it if you'd seen how damn hard it is and you did it anyway.
Yeah. I think, though, that seeing how hard it was the thing that caused me to keep postponing what probably was the inevitable. And that makes me a little bit sad. But then sometimes I think, well, maybe the reason that I have the resilience I have and the reason I never feel like maybe I made a wrong decision or I never question what I'm doing, maybe it's because I gave myself that time and I really was ready.
We're all different. And I think different personality types, you need to experience the other side. Sometimes founders come out and they're 22 and they go bang straight into it and they never know anything else. Sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't. Or they move jobs and they're like, oh my God, I don't believe what I just gave up. I gave up my own thing to go back the other way in terms of they are a founder, they sell out or whatever, and they go back to try work for someone else. And they're like, I just can't do it.
Yeah.
Their frame is broken.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's, the, you know, people always say, oh, you can always go back. You can always go back and get a job. And that's, that is true on the one hand, that there will be jobs available and that, you know,
the none you want to do.
Jobs will be there. But yeah, once you've worked for yourself, that's another measure, that reason I know I'm happy and I know it's right for me. I always say, I have another few startups in me.
Mm.
You know, I'm always,
yeah,
I'm always like, yeah, I'll do good few more.
I think once you're out on your own a certain period of time, it's never going back. Yeah. I would never go back and work for someone else.
No, I couldn't imagine.
Unless someone wants to offer me a huge amount of money. But, you know, joking aside, I wouldn't. Yeah. I just couldn't mentally make that shift back again. When you get that freedom and you get that, it's not even about those, I'm not going to do this today. People think, oh, it's great. You can choose your own hours. Yeah, I'd rather work 60 than work 40 for someone else.
Absolutely.
That's true, though.
I'm not sure I was ever very good at biting my tongue, but I could not imagine, you know, sitting in a C-level meeting now and some other CEO making decisions and me sitting there going, that's what you're going to do? Really?
Great idea, John. We'll fire up that idea straight away. Yeah. That seems like a great plan.
Don't know if that would be the best fit for me now.
Where did the idea for Boundless come from? You kind of hinted at it earlier that you were scratching your own itch. But where did it come from? And then what was the moment where you're like, this is it? Because that question is the one a lot of founders struggle with, going, how will I know?
So I did three stints as a COO, held the role three times. In between, I'd done some consulting work to tech startups, usually around kind of long range planning or prepping for fundraisers or funding transactions. So I'd had lots of exposure to different businesses. And I think by the time I was heading into my third stint of COO, I had started to say, I think the next thing I do will be my own thing. So that was on my radar. You know, I was thinking, I'm getting close to ready. It's going to happen.
Okay.
And like most people that are involved in the startup space, I was always at conferences and meetups and events. So I was always surrounded by people who were a lot more entrepreneurial than me, people who constantly had ideas and were constantly, you know, throwing around. I was always going for coffees with people who'd want to bounce ideas off me, even though, you know, I wasn't the ideas person. So I was in that sphere. So I always had a notebook on the go with ideas. I mean, I'm not necessarily that. Some people have 100 ideas every month. I wasn't that person, but I always had a notebook.
Chipping away.
I was writing stuff down. And every now and again, I always used to say it was like every now and again, a bank holiday weekend. Yeah. It used to be a bank holiday, but like, right, there's 3 days. And I would like go to ground. I'd just be in my hoodie and tracksuit bottoms for the entire weekend, frantically researching an idea. And it'd get to like Sunday afternoon and I'd be like, I don't know about this one.
Nah.
I'm
talk yourself out of it.
I mean, I think I'm, as founders go, I'm probably a little more on the cynical side than some.
You seem quite restrained. I've interviewed a lot of founders. A lot of them are loose cannons in terms of, most of them would have formulated the company by Sunday. They'd be like, we're off and running.
Yeah, I'm not that person. You know, so I'd be quite considerate and I'd be quite looking out for where all the problems could be. So I always said I just never had an idea that survived a bank holiday weekend. Never made it to the end of the bank holiday weekend.
No, nothing made to Monday.
But when I was working at Axonista, I'll tell you this story first and then I'll backtrack and tell you how I met my co-founder, because I had encountered this problem previously. But when I was working at Axonista, we were a remote team. We were hiring people to be based in central Dublin, but people were from lots of different countries. And our customers were all in the US. So Claire was always over and back to the US, and various people from the engineering team would be over and back. So we were set up so people could work from other locations. And then over time, as happens, members of the team were coming to us and saying, I want to move back to my home country because I'm getting married and I want to start a family, or I'm done with the Irish weather. I can't do it anymore, you know, which did happen a couple
can't
of times.
Blame them, yeah.
And these were really talented people with the kind of skills that weren't easy to replace. So we were saying, look, keep your job. You can work remotely from this other country. But then I was running business operations, so I had to figure out how to make that work. And that was when I realized this is a nightmare.
And this is long before COVID, and this is long before it became a thing.
Yeah, this was about 3 years before COVID.
Okay. So that's considerable in a business. Suddenly, remote work is, everyone gets it.
Yeah.
Suddenly, like, remote work 5 years ago, not really a thing.
Yeah.
Freelancers and kind of people threw around the idea of digital nomads, and it almost became like a meme. It almost became like this, oh yeah, digital nomad, aka they're unemployed. You know, whereas now it's completely logical. Our guest this morning, he commutes from South Portugal, Madrid, Dublin. He lives in three different places.
Yeah.
Because he wants
totally
to.
Totally doable.
Because that's the new world.
Yeah. 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 So we were very early when it came to remote working, but the practicalities of how an ops person handles this. So as soon as someone is in another country, as soon as they're in another territory, they're entitled to the protections of the law of that country. Mm. And it doesn't matter where I'm sitting. If I'm their employer, I have to comply with the laws of where they are.
Even though they're employed technically here. I was really curious. I think this couldn't be a better interview at a better time, because I think so many people are now grappling with this.
Yeah.
They're now going...
And it's not easy.
Oh, God. So-and-so joined during COVID. Now they want to go back to, like, Spain.
Yeah.
What do I do?
You know, if we look at Spain, for example, say someone is going to Spain and they're working for an Irish company. Like Irish company, you know, any company based anywhere in the world, you can write whatever you want in an employment agreement and get the person to sign it. That does not trump employment law.
Wherever they're based.
Wherever they are. So, you know, if you think of it this way, you're an Irish citizen, but if you're on vacation in Madrid for the weekend and you commit a murder in Madrid, it's going to be Spanish law that applies.
Yeah.
And it's going to be the Spanish courts that you have to talk to.
Okay.
It's the same thing if you're an employee. If you're on Spanish soil and you're working from Spain, you're in that jurisdiction. It's Spanish employment rights that apply.
Okay.
It's Spanish employer obligations. Your company might be Irish. The employment agreement might say it's under the jurisdiction of Ireland, but it's not.
It's where
the work
they physically
is not being
sit,
done
right?
In Irish jurisdiction. Yeah.
Okay, gotcha.
That's the first thing. So then that's opening up a whole can of worms around, well, what kind of employment agreement do I give them? And it's probably going to need to be dual language. It has to have all of the terms that are expected in that country rather than this country. Then it's all of the benefits stuff. And you know, some of the benefits, some countries, I mean, our benefits seem crackers to people in some other countries. But, you know, some countries have all kinds of crazy benefits that we wouldn't think of here. All kinds of leaves. I mean, lots of countries will have leave for an immediate family member's wedding. You get leave. All kinds of life events, you will get statutory leave in a lot of other countries in a way that you don't hear. I did a 1.5 hour call with a new customer's benefits team yesterday, just thrashing through. All we were talking about was leaves. Wow. Paid time off and leaves of absences. And they have four countries they're going to have people in. So there's all of that. So you need these people on the right employment agreement, but then you as an employer have to meet all of your employer obligations. And that can be everything from giving people meal vouchers to making sure a lot of people have to have a medical in a lot of countries before they start a job.
Okay.
All of that kind of stuff. Then the person set up and they're working for you, but you have to process payroll in the country that they're a tax resident in. So if my person's in Spain, they're going to be registered with the Spanish tax authorities. They're going to want to pay their tax there because they want to benefit from the local healthcare system. They, of course, want and need to be on the right side of the law in that country. And as an employer, much as every employer in Ireland pays employer taxes for its Irish employees, if your person's in Spain, you have to pay your employer taxes in Spain. And once you have people in countries like Spain, France, Italy, you're talking about it can be up to 40% on top of the base salary.
Wow.
A lot. Our employer taxes are quite low compared to a lot of countries. And if you have someone moving from Denmark to France, in Denmark, it's about 1.25% of the salary. But in France, it's going to be closer to 40%, could be up to 50%.
So does that mean your costs as an employer go up 40% for that one employee?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And then you have to process everything through that local tax system. Then if they need pension or perhaps there's a statutory obligation that they get pension, you have to take care of that, private medical insurance. Then you also need to do the stuff that might not be required by law, but everyone in that country just expects it because it's what everyone else gets. So, you know, people here expect to be able to take time off between Christmas and New Year's. It's like there's no law saying your employer has to do that, but it's what we all do.
It's just,
So you need to be aware of that kind of stuff. You know, in France, they all want meal vouchers. It's like, and they all want their long lunch breaks. It's really important.
Okay. Cultural as opposed to legal.
Yeah. And if you're, you know, if you're trying to attract good people and retain good people, you need to be aware of this stuff. Then you get the really, like, it gets really complex when you have, you know, the woman from the Netherlands who's married to a guy from South Africa and she's been living in the UK, but she's about to move to Croatia.
So you've got visas,
there's all of that
stuff.
So that's what we do, is solve all of the problems around this. So I encountered this problem when I was, I've really digressed from your question was about how I came to setting up the company. But when I was at Axonista, we had a number of people in other countries. I set about solving these problems. So that was finding accountants in these countries, finding lawyers in these countries, registering as an employer with the local tax authority.
It must be so slow and time consuming.
A lot of us in Ireland don't realise our system is incredibly efficient here. Like dealing with the tax office here is really straightforward. A lot of the rest of the world does not operate that way. You can register a company here in about a week. You can set up a business bank account in a couple of weeks. It's not that tricky. You don't have to jump through too many hoops. Whoa, the rest of the world is very different. The only places we've come across that will be as easy as here would be UK, Estonia, Singapore. Pretty much everywhere else.
Really?
Absolute nightmare.
Estonia seems to be a complete outlier.
Estonia is, I have I'm director of companies in all of these countries. So I have an e-residency visa for Estonia. And when I went to the embassy in town in Dublin to pick it up, I've never had an experience like this. I rang the bell and they answered and said, "You must be D. Come in, please." And I walked up to the desk and there was a woman at the desk and she had the document for me to sign and a pen. And she said, "Just sign there." And she said, "You're done."
Wow. Because
I just walked out the door again.
It's more or less all digital, isn't it?
It's all digital. And yeah, it's just very early on, the government saw the opportunity in tech and investing in tech. They had Skype. You see, Skype was a really big success story.
Okay.
So the government invested really heavily in tech and tech education. And the government themselves are very tech forward.
I really want to go over there. That's kind of on my mission. Yeah.
We're not far behind.
Really?
Not at all. Like relative to other countries, you know, I mean, I tell you what, it's interesting doing business somewhere like France or like a lot of the Mediterranean countries.
Relaxed.
Very relaxed. Yeah. It takes time. I mean, we love it because that's why we have the business.
Okay. Yeah. But yeah.
You know, but yeah, I have to remind our team all the time when people are tearing their hair out. So many challenges right now with e-signing and banks in Poland. Their online banking systems. Whoa.
Really?
Yeah. Takes up a lot of time figuring this stuff out. And every country has a different set of problems.
It must be beautiful for you as a company, though, because you're building up this knowledge bank and a moat, essentially, in terms of, well, we've done this before. We know exactly what it means to hire someone in Estonia if they're going to work in Spain and then have Irish. Like, that's incredible. Competitive advantage to have.
Absolutely. And we've taken a really different approach compared to a lot of others in the market. So in every country, we have a registered company, the equivalent of a limited company locally.
Oh.
We have a local bank account. We're registered with the local tax authorities. We have our own direct relationships with benefits providers. And that was really important. I'd used some of the service providers in this space before, going back again to my story of how I came to founding the company. I'd used some of the service providers and the experience was horrendous. So I knew that if you wanted to deliver a better product, you had to build a product from the ground up. You had to do every bit of the heavy lifting and you had to have control over the whole customer experience. Now, a lot of people entered this space once COVID kicked off and they saw the remote work opportunity and saw the dollar signs. And a lot of these companies have raised huge sums of money, hundreds of millions, and they decided to piggyback on the infrastructure that was already there. They thought, you know, they were optimizing for speed, thinking, let's just focus on sales and marketing and customer acquisition. the rails are already there. We'll just build a tech customer front end. The customer can interface with that. And at the back end, we'll just outsource all of this stuff. So, you know, now there's been a bit of a passage of time and we're seeing more and more customers moving to us because they've been using these companies and they're saying, well, the experience sucks. Mm. And we're saying, well, yeah, it would, because it always did. It's these really painful to use service providers at the back end.
Yeah.
So for us, we've had to do all this heavy lifting.
I think people realize here for good. This is not a phase. This is not a fad. This is not a COVID thing.
Yeah.
Remote work and working across borders is here forever.
Yeah.
It's such
an genie back in the bottle.
People have suddenly realized, I don't have to be in Ireland 12 months of the year. I don't have to be tied to this company. I really love my company. Whereas before they would have had to go, I'm going to have to leave. I'm going to wherever, Finland. Whereas now it's completely possible.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, I mean, what I find really interesting about all of this is people's attitudes have changed. What people want has changed. Mm. People's eyes are opened to what is possible. But when you look at the realities of the world and when you look at bureaucracy and how governments work and how countries actually interface with each other, that has not changed and it's not changing.
Hmm.
So if you want to live that kind of lifestyle, I mean, the digital, the whole notion of the digital nomad thing, you know, makes us kind of throw our eyes to heaven a little because it's not really practical. I mean, there are lots of people that work for themselves, freelancers that live like that, and that works really, really well.
And that's different. That's a different thing. But if you're a business and a company and this is, you're hiring someone for the next 10 years, you're not hiring someone for a month to do a contract, it's very different.
It's also, it's the reality for the individual. Like digital nomadism works really well for a lot of people for a window of time in their lives.
Yes.
It's probably not how they're going to live for 20, 30 years. What you do see a lot of is people with kids as well might go to this country for 3 months, that country for 6 months, that country for a year. I think we'll see a lot more of that.
I think so.
But this thing of essentially backpacking with your laptop in the backpack and staying in hostels and doing 3 days here and getting a train and doing 4 days there, that and full-time employment, like full-time permanent work, that's a really difficult, it's difficult for everyone involved in that. It's difficult for the company and the employer. It's difficult for the employee.
I think during COVID, kind of all bets were off. All rules were kind of like, yeah, work away. Whereas now people are like, well, we got to do this like ongoing. So we need to figure this out. Like it couldn't be better timing for you. You must have kind of thought, okay, our time is now.
I started working on the idea, you know, I was committed to the idea and said, right, I'm going to give this a go from January 2019. And then spent about 6 months. It's a really complex business from a legal perspective.
It sounds extremely complex.
Yeah. You know, I'm a director of companies in about 35 countries. So there's a lot of complexity.
That's a lot of updating on LinkedIn.
There's a lot of, you know, our finance team have their work cut out for them. Like consolidating those monthly group accounts is interesting.
Oh, wow.
I spent about 6 months going really deep on the operating model, the legalities of it, figuring out how we'd best build this all out, what kind of partners we'd work with, looking at what the costs would be, and then registered the company in May 2019. And that was when it was like, right, you know, start looking for investment, start looking for customers. But it took us a while to build our first MVP. We didn't really, with hindsight, looking back, I guess we could have onboarded customers with our first one or two countries. Unsurprisingly, our first countries were Ireland and the UK. Mm-hmm. Really quick and easy, really straightforward. It just all got a lot harder from there. They were the straightforward ones. And with hindsight, I definitely would have focused more on customer acquisition earlier if I was doing it again.
Okay.
I have a whole plan for that right from the outset. But it wasn't, you know, that wasn't my background and it took me time to figure all of that out. We had 5 countries, I think, on the platform before we started onboarding customers. We started, and then COVID kicked off. Mm. Which
was that good or bad?
Well, people always say, "Oh, when COVID kicked off, you must have got crazy busy." But when it first kicked off, and people were doing emergency work from home, HR leaders weren't saying, oh my God, I must sort out my compliance. You know, they were going, how do I keep everyone alive and how do we survive? Yeah. And, you know, they were trying to get laptops out to people and get screens out to people.
It was purely survival. It wasn't about growth. It wasn't about compliance. It was like,
it was not, no.
Just keep
just
the lights on.
Just get through this. Yeah. And then people were, I mean, it happened. It was so common at the time that it was like, right, we're going to have a 3-week lockdown. So many people in Ireland, so many people from other countries went to their managers and said, listen, I'm going to ride out this 3 weeks back at my mother's house in Italy. And everybody's line manager said, sure, it's just a working
holiday.
It's going to be 3
Enjoy.
Weeks. I'll see. We'll all go out for lunch in 4 weeks' time. You know, and that's not what happened. So people were back in these countries. And at first, companies, I mean, across the board, companies just chose to turn a blind eye to that. Of course, they had so much to focus on. So they weren't focused on compliance. So looking back, actually, we started selling to customers in March 2020. I mean, you know, now I'm like, God, why didn't we just hit pause and come back to it? But yeah, we were trying.
Well, you didn't know. It could have been, is pause going to be a year? Is pause going to be a 3 weeks?
We also kicked off a fundraising process in February 2020, like late February 2020. I mean, our timing.
Hang on. Yeah,
timing
perfect.
Is everything. Yeah, that was painful. So our first customers, we onboarded in kind of the May, June, which now at the time it felt so slow. It was like we've been talking to people since March. Mm. We didn't have a customer until May. Now that sounds like such a short timeline. But at the time we were sweating. Going, we've been talking to people for weeks and we don't have any customers yet. So that first year we had customers, it was summer 2020 was when we started to issue invoices. I mean, so exciting, you know, the first few months you're sending out invoices. It always makes me laugh now. Every month, invoicing day is a really big deal for us because the complexity of our product, the invoices are complex, and the payroll team and the finance team, they're, you know, always let everyone know a couple of days in advance. We have invoicing day this week. So they always let everyone know and they're like, you know, you won't be able to reach me that day. I'll be really busy. But at first it used to be like 4 or 5 invoices would go out. First couple of months, it was like, oh my God, we sent out 5 invoices.
It's a thrill.
Amazing.
Yeah, the magic.
Now they're broken into batches because, you know, we share them. We share some of the information in Slack, so everyone's up to date on how much we're billing. And they go out in batches now, batches of 10. And, you know, I think there's usually like about 20 something batches.
Nice.
Yeah, that feels good to see that.
That's incredible growth in a very short space of time. It doesn't probably
feel
like a short space of time for you.
You're doing it. It just
dog
does
years.
Not at all. It's the days. God, it's a strange way of living. Like the days are so long, but the days also go so fast.
Well, someone said to me about having a kid. They were like, oh, the days are long and the years are short.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, that's probably a great way of putting it.
Yeah. So yeah, I find it hard to believe that we now have, you know, we have 2.5 years of data, 2.5 years we have customers that have been with us 2.5 years. Mm-hmm. A lot of our early customers are still with us.
I'd imagine it's a very sticky product though.
It is so sticky. Yeah. This, you know, you asked me earlier about how I decided to work on this. I had all of these ideas and I had a list of criteria for my business ideas.
It was
like,
me.
You
hit
know,
me.
A good...
I love a good list. Go on.
You know, I was like, a good business idea has to fulfill... And it was like a list I had written down and I would cross-reference. I'm that kind of person. I would cross-reference against my list. And it had to be something where the price point per customer, it needed to be more than like a couple... I wanted it to be more than a couple of $1,000 a month. You know, I wanted it to be... I always said I wanted it to be like whatever the limit is on a credit card. Now, our customers aren't paying with credit cards because they're also paying us a payroll bill.
It's a good way of thinking about it, though. Yeah,
I think it's actually for SaaS businesses, I think it's a really good way of thinking about it because if you're selling to bigger companies, most managers or leaders have a credit card and they're allowed to buy things that are maybe up to the limit of that credit card. But once they go beyond the limit of a credit card, it usually has to go through a procurement process and they have to get certain sign-offs they otherwise wouldn't need, which
Finance.
Makes it a much
Gotta
harder
sign
sell.
Off. Okay.
You
Brilliant.
Know, your sales team needs to be different. Your sales process is different. Your sales cycles are longer. So I always said, I wanted the average customer to be paying us a few grand a month. Now, I'm very happy to say we have lots of customers that pay us lots and lots of grand a month. You know, they're paying a lot more now. But I wanted it to be somewhere around that. I did not want to be serving customers that were paying 40, 50 quid a month, because I've been there, I've seen it. Those ones are harder work than the person paying you 20 grand a month.
People never yeah. realize that. You don't know it until you do. And you're like, the good customers are less time than the bad customers who are paying us 10x less.
Yeah. And I'd been in a SaaS business where we had a lot of customers that were paying us 40, 50 quid a month. And it's tough. Mm. It takes a long time to get to 1 million ARR if people are paying you 40, 50 quid a month.
Criteria one, was it going to be always tech SaaS?
Yeah, I mean, that's where I had come from. I worked in the music industry for 7 years before moving into tech, but tech feels like home.
Okay.
It's my space, B2B SaaS, yeah.
Okay, criteria one, B2B SaaS. B2B criteria SaaS. Two, paying us the credit card limit, magic number. What else?
There needed to be, like, the customer had to have an existing need for this product and be actively looking for a solution. I didn't want to have to go and educate the whole world on why this thing that was happening was a problem and why they needed a solution.
Painkillers,
I wanted something
not
where they were out there, exactly, where people were actually out there looking for a solution and where there would already be budget allocated to it. So they wouldn't have to go scrabbling and go back to their CFO and go, we need to create a new line item.
What is it?
But this doesn't fit on my spreadsheet. Where do I put it? Didn't want that. The market, you know, the market had to be a big market internationally. And I knew from pitching to VCs, it needed to be something that was where the total addressable market was billions. And often when people are new to startups, they say, but this amazing market is worth 150 million a year. If we could just get 10% of that market, we'd have a 15 million a year business. And you're like, first of all, you're never going to get 10% of any market. Secondly, a 150 million market's actually a really small market. Like, you can build a great business in that space, but you're not going to raise venture capital investment because VCs, they just operate a different model. Yeah. They're looking for things at different kind of scale. So it had to be that kind of size problem. And then the sales cycle. I had worked at both ends of the spectrums. You know, I'd worked in a business where the sales cycles were a couple of weeks. And when I was working with Misabi, the transit ticketing company, our sales cycles were 3 years.
Wow.
Now, that's a great business. And that is a business that has grown to scale. But you need the kind of patience I didn't have at that time.
And as a startup, 3 years, you're not making it to 3 years.
We did with that business, but we had to raise a lot more investment than we ever thought. It's so funny now. And I haven't seen them in quite a while, but I do see the guys from Misabi now and again, and we laugh about it. I remember, you know, I was doing all of the financial projections and we were going to investors and we were looking for 750K. And everyone was like, lads, that is just such an odd number. You need to raise a million. Mm-hmm. 750, nobody's investing 750K. Like, you'll get someone to give you 250K or you'll get someone to give you a million. People don't. This was years ago. This was like 14 years ago in London. But people were like, it's too odd. Do a million. I remember we used to
round it up there.
We used to sit together and go, how would we ever spend £1 million? And we were deadly serious. We were not children. We were grown adults. But we were green. We were naive. We hadn't. The guys had been developing apps for years and they were incredible technologists, but none of us had really run a business. Mm. And we were like, £1 million, that's so much money. Mm. And, you know, they've raised like, I think 30, 40 million now. In my time there, we did 9 million. And believe me, we were well able to spend it. I knew whatever I was going to do was going to be a VC backed business because that was kind of where I came from. It was my world. So they were the key things. The buyer decision maker, you had to be able to identify them and you had to be able to get to them. You had to be able to figure out how you could get to them.
I love that. I love a very clear criteria because everyone's like, oh yeah, I'm going to come up with an idea for a business. I just don't know where to start. Start there. Start by identifying what you want to do, not you do want to do.
You know where I'd start though? And it was interesting because a friend of mine, at the time we were talking about, he actually was my now co-founder. He actually told us to talk to each other. So a friend of mine, we were talking about doing something together. And I said very early on, well, let's sit down and figure out what do we both want out of this? What, you know, in terms of our lives, why are we doing this? Why are we starting a startup? I would start there. Because he'd been involved in startups for years. He'd had a startup before, but I forced some hard questions. He was saying, I really want work-life balance.
Mm.
His kid was quite young at the time, and he was saying, I want work-life balance. And I was like, on the one hand, we're saying that, and the other hand, we're saying we're going to build a venture-backed business, and we want to build it to scale. And I was like, and you know, I started, I think I kind of dropped some truth bombs, and I was like, it's not going to be that kind of journey. And then he realized, you know what, after having this conversation, he's done really interesting stuff and loads of really interesting consulting work since then, but he's not started a startup. He realized that wasn't what he wanted from his life.
But this goes back to your earlier point of, you don't want to get down the tracks and then go, 18 months in, especially if you're with other founders. I met a founder, I think it was in October. I sat down with him. He's like, oh, can I have a coffee with you? I want to bounce some stuff off you. And he was saying, oh, you know, this is our idea and we're kind of working on it. And I was like, okay, when you say we, how do you mean? He's like, well, there's four founders. I was like,
four is a lot.
Okay. I was like, step me through. Who are they? He's like, okay, well, so-and-so is working on it part-time. He's got a full-time job somewhere here. So-and-so is in school, in college. And then this person's working for this other company. And then there's me. I was like, and you're all founders. Who's working on it full time? Me. Okay. Do you own most of the equity? No. Do you have a founder's agreement? No. Do you know what they want to do? No. And I was like, do nothing else. Do not build another brick. Do not build another line of code until you go and sit down and have that exact conversation.
Yeah.
Because it might just be a miscommunication. It might be a naivety. It might just be having to have a hard conversation.
That alignment is so important. So me and Emily, my co-founder, and I have to come back and tell you how I started working with Emily, because that's interesting as well. We check in on this very regularly. We spend a lot of time together. It's a bit of a running joke. Whenever she comes to Dublin, she lives in France. When she comes to Dublin, she always says, Dee, this time now, you know, we'll go for dinner, but then that's it. I need to spend more time with my family. I'm coming home. We can't be like out every night. And then she comes home, and she was here the week before last, and we went out every night she was here. So, you know, we do spend a lot of time together. And when we are, and we're going to London together later this week, you know, we'll go for drinks together, go for dinner together. We spend a lot of time socially together as well as work stuff. But we also do check-ins that we schedule. They're in the calendar.
I like that.
We are very aligned, but we don't take that for granted. So
people
every
change.
Couple of months,
we all assume we're this straight line. Everyone is the same. People change.
Totally.
People's desires change.
Totally.
People's interest changes. People's COVID changed a lot of people's priorities.
Yeah.
So if you're a founder and you're like 2 years in with a co-founder and I'm not feeling it.
Yeah.
What happens? I said even do that. I said even look, have a schedule. Whereby
yeah,
after
we,
six
we literally
months, 12 months,
it.
18 months, 2 years.
We sit down. I mean, more often than not, because we talk about this stuff all the time. You know, we talk about it. We do a WhatsApp. We phone each other on WhatsApp every Tuesday and Thursday morning. And we just almost shoot the breeze. But it will always be,
something
will
come out.
I have this thing I needed to bring up. I need to talk about this. I need to talk about that. So it's not, those meetings are founder check-ins. We have a C-team meeting where with the broader C-team, we talk through the company goals and key strategic problems we need to figure out. But these founder check-ins are to talk about how we're working together and how we're feeling about things.
I love that.
And outside of that, we will also then have these regular check-ins where, and we'll always say, I think we're on the same page because we talked about it last week and the week before and the week before. But, you know, we did it the week before last. We went out for dinner and we sat down and we both said to each other, what do you want? What do you want this year? How are you feeling about it? How many more years do you think you can go? You know, are you having thoughts of like, do you need to know there is an end point? Yeah. Are you feeling that? Or are you still feeling energized and into it? And, you know, last year, like so many companies, we had a bit of a cash crunch and it was tough. And we had a few really rocky weeks where we were trying to figure stuff out and it was extremely pressurized. We did have to lose some of our team, which was extremely sad. And that was rough. That was really, really rough. But I do remember saying to her, I think when we look back in the longer term, we will say this is one of the worst weeks we've ever had. And we both said to each other, if this is as bad as it gets, I can keep going. I can keep doing this. We're both in it for the long haul, and we have bad days. I mean, you have a day where we'll often shed a little tear on a Zoom call with each other. We'll just go, I'm feeling really frustrated, or I'm really tired, or this is hard. This has been a really hard week. And the great thing is, I don't know how anyone does it as a solo founder. The great thing is, when I'm having a bad week, she'll be like, actually, I know last week I was saying it's really hard, but this week I'm having a great week. It's brilliant. And
a bad day doesn't become a bad week, which doesn't become a bad month, which doesn't become a bad year, which ultimately leads to your downfall.
Yeah.
I think that is a huge lesson.
We're resilient people, but better and more important than that, we know how to weather storms together. Mm. We have a sense of humor. And even when things are really bad, we're good when things are bad. She said that to me actually. And, when we were having a bit of a cash crunch last year, she was like, we're really good in a crisis. And we were joking, saying, how do we throw more crises in next year? But, you know, we are good in a crisis. We're both extremely solutions oriented people.
That's it. A lot of founders are. Yeah.
If you're looking for a founder, that is a co-founder. That is what I would look for. The kind of person who's going to bury their head in the sand and say, I can't deal with this. Or who's going to avoid. Mm. Or the kind of person who's going to go, I'm just going to have to leave this one to you because this is too much for me. I'm not able for it. Like that's...
Yeah. Now is not the time to tell me that.
Yeah. And the two of us are very... When there's a problem, we're like, right, what are we going to do about it? And that's, you know, you power through when things are tough. And that's powerful, but it's powerful for your relationship as well. And the next time you hit a bump, once you've been through the really steep crevices and the really tough times, the bumps just feel like bumps. Mm. And you get better at smoothing out those bumps together. And you know you can do it. When you've been through some really tough stuff, when another problem comes along, you're like, of course we can get through this.
But clear communication, it's just fundamental to every relationship you'll ever have. And people don't bring that into business world because mightn't like what they want to hear. They might kind of, and everyone's full of the joys of spring. At the start, you are full of enthusiasm and fun and life, and it's going to be magic and imagine what's going to happen. But very few founders go and then have that conversation and then have it again and again and again and again.
Well, the reality is when you found a business, like it depends on the space you're operating. Yeah. I'm very, when I talk about running businesses, my experience is all from the tech world. So I realize that's very skewed from some people's
perspective. The principles and the fundamentals are there though.
Yeah. Really. But generally when you found a business, certainly if you're founding something like a SaaS business in the tech space, you're going to be doing it for years, right? I mean, sometimes you meet, you know, sometimes you go to like incubator programs or something. And, you know, I mentor a lot on these programs, or I'd often be at the networking events and you meet people and they say, yeah, I'm starting this company and I'm going to sell it in 18 months time. And you're like, right. I really hope that works out for you.
Make it to 18 months and you'll be flying.
Yeah, I think the average, you know, the data shows the average is about 7 years before an exit. So I think you should assume you're going to be doing it for 7 to 10 years. In that period of time, you and your co-founder or co-founders are going, you will have life events. You know, you will have people close to you that you love will be sick. People will pass away. You might have money problems. You might be going through big positive life things, like you might be getting married or buying a house. You have to weather those things together. Those things will always affect your work. Mm. They will always affect your work. And, you know, as founders, you will change as people. The world will change. You will have to constantly weather storms. But you will also have to see each other through those life things. Mm-hmm. And you know, everyone doesn't, like, people cannot show up 100% day after day after day after day after day for 10 years. Like, that nobody, unless you hire a robot, that is not the performance you're going to get. So you have to be able to work with each other when one of you is like, I'm not feeling, I'm having a bad, and sometimes you will have a bad week.
Were you always going to have a co-founder?
I never would have done this without a co-founder.
Okay.
I was inconceivable.
And you were self-aware to know that.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. I started working on the idea without a co-founder. I also knew that the wrong co-founder was going to be a bigger problem than no co-founder. So I held out. I had worked with Emily at Bizimply. She was the lead engineer there.
Okay.
But really interestingly, I love this story. And I always have to say to VCs, it's actually a true story. It's not
origin
poetic
myth.
License.
We didn't just throw this in for a good slide on the deck.
Emily was my first ever internationally remote employee.
There you go.
She came to us and, you know, Emily's very clear in her communications and she has good boundaries. She came to us and she said, I have a proposition, but it's a deal breaker. I'm going to Chamonix in France. I'm going for a ski season. I want to be able to do my job from there. But if you can't support me with that, I'll be handing in my notice.
Oh, so I love the confidence. Lord grant me 5% of Emily's confidence this year.
She's a software engineer. They all know they'll get another job in the morning, probably paid twice as much as they were paid before.
Oh, God bless Emily's confidence. I want that.
So, you know, she walked out of the room and we kind of said to each other, oh God, Emily's amazing. We can't lose her. You know, and we said, you know, it's one ski season. It's only going to be a few months. Yeah. Let's say it's fine. So we said that was fine. I didn't have a blooming clue how you would employ someone in France. We said, you know, it's only going to be a short period of time. It'll be absolutely fine. But Emily is still there. She still lives in Chamonix in France. That was about, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago. So she was my first ever internationally remote employee. And from her perspective, she came to this problem being the person on the other side.
So you both had intimate experience of what it took.
So she, when she moved to Chamonix, it's so we laugh about it now because I didn't actually know her very well then. We didn't know each other well until we started working together. And my friend that I was exploring the business opportunities with, he was her CTO.
Okay.
And when I started working on Boundless and I was always bouncing my ideas off him, he said, you need to talk to Emily. And he went to Emily and said, Emily had handed in her notice. She was leaving at this stage. She just wanted to do something new. And he said to her, he didn't tell her what I was working on. He didn't tell me anything about what she wanted to do. He said to her, you should talk to Dee. She's working on this business idea. You should talk to her. So we went for a coffee in Container Coffee down in Dublin 8, down by the NDRC, as it was known back then. We went for a coffee there. We actually went there last week. It was our first time being back there. We had a coffee there together again.
Nice.
We sat down, we had a coffee and I said to her first, so what are you doing? You've handed in your notice. Today's your last day at work. What are you doing? And she said, well, I'm going skiing. Or she was biking across the Alps for, I don't know, it was 7 weeks or something. And she said, and then I've decided whatever I do next, I want it to be an enabler for remote work. So she had gone to Chamonix in France. It's all very full circle.
It really is. I'm getting emotional over here.
Gone to Chamonix in France and she started working out of this co-working space called the Ski Locker. And I remember her first week there. And like I say, I didn't know her very well because I was operations. She was engineering. We didn't work together. Yeah. But I do remember her showing me the co-working space on a Zoom call and her
saying, sounds unreal. The Ski Locker, yeah. I'm in.
But I remember her saying, it's really quiet. There aren't many people here. But over the years, it got busier and busier.
I'd say it's jammers now.
It's jammers, but also the woman that owns it has just started working for us. She's a lawyer. No. She's a tech lawyer. Yeah, she just started working for us last week. So it's nice. So, and we have another colleague, Max, who works out of there as well. But she observed that this co-working space was getting busier and busier. And what she found really interesting was that she had been a civil engineer and she'd left civil engineering because she wanted to decouple work from her location. She's very into outdoorsy, extreme sports type stuff. And she wanted to live where that was, but do really interesting technical work.
Yeah.
So she became a software engineer so that she could have that lifestyle. It was like this journey. And she spent years getting to that point, you know.
But she knew the end, what the end goal was.
That was the end goal.
I love that.
So she then observed all of these other people doing it. And what she found really interesting was at this co-working space, at first it was all software engineers. But then she started to notice people like civil engineers. She was like, there are people with all kinds of jobs here. And people used to come to her for advice, because when they'd arrive at this co-working space and they'd say, oh yeah, I'm working remotely. And this, you know, this is like 5 years ago when people didn't have friends who worked remotely.
It was still an outlier activity. Yeah. It was still like, oh, did you hear about Dee?
Yeah.
She's going off to live in Argentina. And be like, oh my God.
So people would come and it'd be their first week out there in France and they'd say, I'm doing this remote work thing. And people, everyone there used to say, talk to Emily. She was the oldest. She's the longest person renting a desk there.
Oh, wow.
We would say, talk to Emily. She's been doing this for ages. So at the time I talked to her, she was considering writing a book about remote work. And she knew she wanted to be an enabler for other people living their lives that way. And then
life's funny too.
And then she said to me, so what are you working on? And I said, well, Emily, you won't believe it. And I described what Boundless was going to be. And that's how we ended up working together.
That is a good story.
Yeah.
I thought you were giving me the origin myth there, but I was like, definitely she is a banger story. That's a cracker. I said the VCs eat that one up.
They do. They like it. They like it. Yeah.
You talked about something there about at the very start. You mentioned just thinking beyond Ireland. Do enough Irish entrepreneurs do that? Do we see the big picture?
No. And I find it interesting because, no, lots do. Lots do. But there are too many that don't. This is a tiny country. It's a tiny, tiny little island with a tiny population. Like, it is a little island. Our population is so small compared to almost every other country in the world.
Every other city, you go to the Manchester. Every time I go to Manchester, I'm like, oh my God, the world's big.
I'm going there in the morning.
I will
look at it through those eyes.
Oh, I love it.
So, yeah, I think all the time I talk to founders, and again, you know, at accelerator programs or incubators, I talk to people who are working on very early stage ideas. And so often I hear people say, so we'll launch in Ireland, and once we've figured out the Irish market, then we'll go to our next market. And I always say, I get that you need to pick one territory, right? Yeah. You need to pick one territory to be your launch country. Absolutely. Why would you pick one of the smallest ones on the planet? Like, your life's just going to be easier if there's a bigger population. And the people that do look, the earlier you look outward, like, it will pay off for you. It will pay off. And I know people often say, I don't have money. Like, I know what it's like. I started a business. I didn't have any money. I didn't have any investment for the first 8 months I was working on Boundless. I know what that's like. I know, you know, I don't have family money or anything like that. I had to scrimp and save and work my way. And I know what it's like to really have to count the pennies. But people so often say, oh, I don't have the money for a flight here or a flight there. But you should be able to figure out that if you pay for a flight somewhere, you should be able to figure out a way that you know you're going to make that money back.
You flight to Manchester, yourself, 100 quid, let's say, yeah.
Set yourself targets and goals. And, you know, I'm going to Manchester tomorrow. It's an Enterprise Ireland event. They are bringing together a number of people who will be the kind of buyers that we sell to. And I'm going to be presenting to that room of people. And I know if I get one good sales lead out of that, that trip is more than paid for. So that's just a no-brainer for me, because I know it's the right audience in that room. But if it was a different kind of audience, I'd probably say no, because I'd say, oh, it's very unlikely I'll get a sale.
This goes back to your criteria, though. You have to be smart as to what you build.
Yeah.
What do you build? Is there enough margin in there? Don't just start doing something. Work it backwards.
Yeah.
Is your product expensive enough? Are you charging enough? Do you have the ability to go beyond Ireland because you're charging enough?
Yeah.
It all goes back to the very start. That's why I loved your criteria idea. By being smart at the start, you can save yourself a lot of pain in the middle.
Yeah, absolutely. That, you know, I'm a big planner. You know, I do like to look down the road, see where do you want to go? Where do you want to get to? And then figure out the plan for what it's going to take to get there. Don't start here and incrementally put the blocks down going that way. Start over there.
Reverse engineer it backwards and go, right, if I want this. And it comes back to knowing what you want as well. Though I think when you start a business, it's not your first business or it's not your first job. I think it's easier to go, well, I know what I don't want. I definitely know these are the errors I've made along the way. So I think it does get easier as you go. So would that be your advice? What would your advice be when you mentor to all these kind of younger entrepreneurs or first-time entrepreneurs? What is your kind of tenets of advice that you give them in terms of looking beyond Ireland?
So the first thing I'd say when I give people advice is you might or might not want to listen to me. You know, there's no, you know, there's no one size fits all, right?
Well, it comes through a lens.
Yeah. Yeah, but my lens is always going to be different. You know, that expression, your own mileage may vary. Like, this is the problem with taking advice from people, and I take advice from loads of people, but I have, that's some advice I'd give you. Be careful who you take advice from. And I'm quite rigorous about this. If I have a problem I want to solve, and I solve all my problems by reaching out to people in my network. I constantly have a list of people I want to reach out to ask specific questions to. I really can't place enough emphasis on how important a network is, and then use that network. But the older I get and the more experience I get, the fewer people I ask for advice. If I have a problem, I will never ask more than two or three people for advice. If you ask seven people, you're going to get seven different answers,
yeah,
and your head will be spinning.
Mm-hmm.
But you could go... And as well, it's not like there are people in my network that are amazing, phenomenal people. And there are some people you can go to about almost anything. I mean, you know, someone like Brian Caulfield, I'm sure you know Brian. I ask Brian about all kinds of problems. And myself and Emily have a bit of a motto. It's Brian Caulfield and C Camp are investors of ours as well. Brian was the first person who ever said he'd give me a check for Boundless.
Really?
Very nice.
We had him on last year. It was an unreal episode.
He's great. And then Seed Camp are investors of ours. And myself and Emily have a motto. We're like, well, Brian and Carlos are always right. Carlos Espinel, our advisor at Seed Camp. It's like everything you ask them everything they say, it always pans out. It always turns out to be true. So, you know, there are a couple of people where you're like, well, their knowledge is gold. But generally you want to go to a person who has experienced the problem you're trying to solve,
yes,
within a specific window. Like, you need them to have solved the problem in the last 3 years, mm-hmm, or so. If they solved that problem 7-8 years ago, first of all, their memories will be warped. Secondly, the world is totally different right now. So you need to talk to, you know, we're on a journey now to 10 million ARR. That's our goal for this year. So this year I will be talking to people that have been on that journey for that range of ARR growth within the last couple of years. The people who've gone to 50 million ARR in the last couple of years, like, the problems they've solved are so different to mine. But these people were not the people I was talking to 2 years ago. When we were trying to get our first million ARR, you're talking to a different group, yeah, of people. So be careful who you ask for advice. And when I give advice to people, I always say that I know a lot of stuff, right? But there's so much stuff. The list of things I don't know is so much longer, yeah, than the things I do know. And you might get me on a funny day and my advice might be slightly skewed and maybe I position it slightly differently on a different day. Take everything.
And
I
people
say
retrofit. People kind of sometimes retrofit their advice to kind of go, look how right I was back then with this great idea.
Yeah.
Instead, yeah, it was timing, luck.
Yeah.
So it's that's good advice, bad advice.
Generally take advice from, like, when people ask me, I was on a panel recently, and they asked me something about a question about consumer businesses. And I just went, I can't answer that question. I've never worked for a consumer business in my life. And I'm not joking. The person moderating the panel said, oh yeah, but you know, based on your experience, what would you say? And I'm not answering that question because my advice would be terrible. And they pushed me a third time. And I just said, I can't, like, anything I say, it's just going to be a pile of muck.
Panels are funny,
though. Anyone.
It's rare to do a good panel. It's rare to manage a good panel. It's a very tricky thing to do.
Yeah. So first up, be careful listening to what I say. But advice on internationalizing, like, I just think you just have to get out there and do it. Like, there are events, there are entrepreneurs events, founder events, startup events in every city of any size in the world. And very early on, I would have gone to a lot of events. And if I was going to a city, I would be looking up what events are on. And I would go to, like, you know, if I was in New York, I was going to like three events a night. I wasn't
Brilliant.
Just picking one and going to it. I was like, I will do this one from 5 to 7. I'll do that one from 7 to 9. And then maybe I can get the last half hour of that one.
Class.
And I would ricochet around the city, running, and to see who I could meet and what was going on. And that's how you get a sense of a city and a place and the people. And you're always learning. Like, you might not walk out the door with a handful of business cards of people you're going to contact afterwards, but you'll be smarter, you'll know more.
If you get one thing, it's worth it.
And I think that's where you start, is actually being in a city, getting to know a city. So I didn't have a network in Dublin when I moved back here from London. How long ago was it now? 10 years ago. And what I did was, Facebook was a big thing back then. Remember Facebook? I posted on Facebook and I said, who in Dublin knows? I had friends in Dublin. I'd gone to college here, but I didn't know people in tech. I said, who in Dublin knows people in tech? And like maybe two friends replied, and they each introduced me to one person. And then I went and I met each of, I messaged those people and I said, this is probably a good example, actually, me moving back here. I'd set myself, I think it was like, there was a period of like maybe, I don't know how long it was, 6 weeks, 8 weeks, I don't know, over a number of weeks or months. I said, right, I'm going to go over. I was living in London. I said, I'll go over and back to Dublin. I'll go like every second week. And I will just go for coffees with people.
So you started building a name before you came back.
Yeah, and everyone smart. I met, I said, who else should I talk to? And I just went for coffee with anyone that would have a coffee with me. And within about 6 months, I knew everyone in the tech space here. And I was going to events and I'd walk in the door and I'd know the people. And, you know, that's a really good path to starting to sell in a country.
Get out, I think physically, get out there.
Yeah,
actually get out.
Yeah. And you don't have to, you know, I'm saying this, but on the other hand, I am going to tell you that I have met virtually none of our customers in person. We do all of our sales online. We're just closing a multi-million dollar annual deal right now. I have not met any of those people in person.
Magic, yeah.
It's all online. They're in lots of different countries. Their team are spread all over. You know, you don't necessarily have to, but I'm always in learning mode, but I'm not in that intense learning mode I was when startups were very early to me and being there was really important.
Final question. Is there a book you'd recommend that's kind of had an impact on you personally or professionally? It can be something you've enjoyed, can be something you'd learn from.
I'm not going to be able to remember the name of them now. There's a guy, you might be familiar with the books. There were some books I read very early on. I'm blank on his name, so I won't talk about that one. I read business books all the time. I read a lot of books. So I've read all of the like classic ones, like The Hard Thing About Hard Things and, you know, The Entrepreneur's Dilemma and there's a couple of really good ones about growth. I can picture the cover. It's like a guy who's sprinting and there's an upward graph, predictable revenue.
Okay.
I don't know that I've never read the perfect business book, right? I think most of them probably.
It's like the events thing though. If you take one thing from it.
Yeah.
Because a lot of books are like 280 pages. You're like, that could have been a blog post.
Totally. Most of them could have, you know, they could have been a Twitter thread. and I do browse a lot on Twitter and I learn a lot from Twitter. But I think the value of reading books, and I'm a big believer in reading long form books, is that, yeah, there might be only snippets that are the really useful things. But if you read something long form, you have that opportunity to sit with the information. And maybe they're making the same point 17 times, but that hammering home is probably useful.
I believe the exact same thing. I think there's all these like, oh, this book digested down to 30 seconds. Oh, this book is in like 10 minutes. I'm like,
that's not
really the point. I think that's the kind of read a Twitter thread if that's what you want to get out of it. For me, it's the same. For me, it's just giving yourself the time.
Yeah.
The time for yourself to read a book, to sit down and go, okay, I'm going to think about revenue, or I'm going to think about marketing or psychology or whatever it is, and just more so just letting the brain decompress because we're so bombarded by all different types of media and information. Just the chance to sit down and read a book over the space of 2 weeks, it's often not the book, it's the ideas that come out of it.
Absolutely. I listen to a lot of audiobooks as well. I used to feel that audiobooks didn't. I feel like I've trained myself to listen to audiobooks.
I go
more.
Over and back on it.
I
go through
more.
Phases.
Yeah, I early when I started listening to them, I felt like I wasn't really absorbing the information and I would drift off. But that doesn't happen to me as much now. And I do find like I'll take notes when I listen to an audiobook as well.
I think it depends where you are in your journey and in your cycle. Mm. Everything's seasonal. You go through different seasons as a person. Sometimes the right book at the right time. And again, it depends on what where you are.
Around the time I was starting Boundless, I was plowing through the books.
You're looking for that silver bullet.
The audiobooks, I was, yeah. And I think that's important at that time when it's ideation and you're making decisions. Whereas now, I probably lean more now on network and people.
Yeah.
So I'm obsessed with asking people how their sales teams are structured. Everyone I meet that has a business, I'm like, what's yours? Tell me about your sales team. Tell me about your sales leader. Where did you find them?
Anyone listening with a killer sales team, get in touch with Dee.
Yeah.
Dee, who's your ideal client? Who's listening to this right now and going, yeah, I should reach out to Dee. What do they look like?
Anyone who is a people leader. We do end up talking to heads of legal, CFOs, senior ops people, but it's usually a people leader. Anyone that's had this problem, when I'm talking about the problem, they're throwing their eyes up to heaven saying, oh my God, yes, I hate this problem. If they've encountered it, they'll know the value of a good solution. But there are a lot of really bad solutions in this space. So anyone that has been dealing with a crummy employer of record, come and talk to me.
Where can they get in touch with you?
My email address is dwe@boundlesshq.com. You can check out the website at www.boundlesshq.com.
Perfect. Dee, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, please hit subscribe on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts, as it really does help the podcast grow and reach new people. If you want to learn more about the podcast, go to mrgaryfox.com. I'll see you back here in a couple of days for a brand new episode.